The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside D.C.'s Beltway on July the 8th in the year of our Lord 2021. And they are still celebrating in England this morning because let's begin with the good news. Why are they out in the streets of England with their celebration? Ben, you can play the background. This is just going on. They're over at the Telegraph. When England scored the 2-1 go-ahead goal in overtime, they had another 15 minutes to wait before the game was over. And Harry Kane will never buy another drink in anywhere in England. They beat Denmark. They have advanced to the Euro finals. It's the first finals of anything that England has been in 55 years. And they avoided a dreaded replay of the disaster of 55 years ago when they did not advance. So Wembley, I got a much longer one. This is, I'm just going to show this tape. They are all over London, Piccadilly Circus, everywhere. It sort of foreshadows a tenth of what will happen in Cleveland and northeastern Ohio after the Browns win the Super Bowl this February 11th at SoFi Stadium in L.A. I mean, this is going to be minor league compared to that, but it's pretty big. The English take their soccer very, very seriously. So we begin on that high point. A 2-1 win for England takes them into a final against Italy. The Three Lions at the England club. And Harry Kane, our hats are off to you. We're happy for our UK cousins. Now to the bad news, and boy, there's a lot of it. There are four suspects dead, tracked down after the assassination of Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, in Haiti yesterday. The news broke as I came on the air yesterday morning, and it is described as an assault. Reports of foreign mercenaries. It's the lead story in the Financial Times. It's the lead story in the Washington Post. Police capture, kill, alleged assailants, and assassination of Haitian president. The New York Times has many stories on the capture of the hit squad members. As grisly details emerged, there were explosives, there were machine guns. The nation's sixth prime minister declared he was in charge, Mr. Joseph. He's the sixth prime minister in 4 years. The United Nations has been there forever and can't bring stability to that country. Just say a prayer for it. We have lots of missions down there, lots of missionaries, lots of orphanages, lots of various groups at work every day, including Food for the Poor. Our friends for Food for the Poor will be rushing supplies there because the modest supply chains and the delicate infrastructure will collapse after this. And I'm sure we'll be asking you for support soon, but not yet. Just first, everyone is being safe. No reports of unrest directed at anyone other than the presidential palace. More bad news from Afghanistan, where the Wall Street Journal front page carries a generation of Afghan professionals flees ahead of Taliban advance. The question is, why wouldn't you? Democrats are in charge. Any kind of a negotiated peace is a facade now. Mike Pompeo led good talks in Qatar before the handover to Team Biden. I'll have the former Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, join me later in the show today to talk about this. Bagram Air Force Base has been abandoned and turned over, and thousands upon thousands of Afghanis are scrambling to get out. Teachers and lawyers, media professionals. Mr. Hadiri is one who runs a television network. Very, very important. Hamid Hadiri was 7 years old when he woke up to see Taliban fighters fan into his western Kabul neighborhood in September of 1996. The Afghan capital had fallen overnight. Militants were soon banging on doors and pulling men aside for execution. Mr. Hadiri now heads the new operation for ITV. A booming television network, one of the many new fields that have flourished in Afghanistan over the past two decades. With only a few hundred American troops remaining in the country, mostly to protect the U.S. Embassy, Mr. Hadiri says he hears the same question from his staff. What shall we do if we wake up to see the Taliban occupying Kabul again? Shall we leave? If so, where and how? Mr. Hadiri went to India in January after warnings of an assassination attempt by insurgents. He returned in March or April and intends to stay in Kabul for as long as he can. Since meeting with Taliban representatives in Doha, Qatar, part of the stalled Afghan peace process, Mr. Hadiri has concluded that a freewheeling TV network won't survive the Islamist movement's rule. The network has already pulled several journalists from Taliban's besieged cities back to Kabul. No one knows what will happen, Mr. Hadiri said. It's Afghanistan. In the future, there will be bloodshed, there will be killings, and maybe civil war. But if there won't be any free media, if we shut down, no one will know what kinds of crime will be happening in Afghanistan. The TV company's owner, Fahim Hashimi, was looking at a contingency plan of moving the network to Turkey or Uzbekistan. I'm joking to get my visas to Turkey, India, and the United Arab Emirates, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan, the few destinations that remain relatively accessible. Even the friends who want to stay here are taking their families out because when war comes, children and women cannot fight and will be vulnerable. So it's a pretty grim situation. Tokyo, more bad news. Spectators at the Olympics may be barred. There's a new COVID emergency as the Delta variant has gripped some parts of Japan. And the Japanese government declared, according to New York Times, a new state of emergency in Tokyo on Thursday after a sudden spike in coronavirus cases, wreaking fresh havoc on preparations for the Olympic Games that organizers have insisted can be held safely amid a pandemic. Tokyo reported 920 new coronavirus infections on Wednesday. That's the highest number there since May. And the Delta spread is not limited to countries where the vaccine is not widely distributed. It's surging in Nevada, for example, in the United States. 2,700 inmates have died, according to a study in United States prisons. But Nevada is the hot spot right now. 40% of the adult population has not gotten a shot in Nevada. No, I don't understand that at all, because Nevada is basically two cities, Reno and Vegas. Yeah, there's Tahoe. Yeah, there is North Las Vegas, Henderson, places like that. But everyone is close, basically, to a hospital or a pharmacy. And you got to get going. I'm on in Las Vegas right now. You're coming home from the late shift at the casino or the show. Just drop by your local pharmacy. They'll have it. It's everywhere. You don't want to mess around with this stuff. You really don't. 53% of the United States has been fully vaccinated, probably enough to stop major surges anywhere. But Clark County, that should not be happening. And it is. It is happening. Capitals, California revives a mask rule after an outbreak there infected four people. So you can't go back into the state capital without a mask. That had been dropped for a while. Britain's health secretary foresees record cases after their, quote, Freedom Day. Nobody's listening to Javid today. They're celebrating over there. And Haiti's turmoil, according to WHO, no surprise, is going to hamper efforts there. Meanwhile, Russian hackers stand accused of breaching a contractor for the RNC last week, around the same time that Russian cyber criminals launched the single largest global ransomware attack, according to the New York Times, incidents that are, quote, testing red lines set by President Biden. They're not testing red lines. They've broken through them. It's a whatever President Biden said to President Putin, it was interpreted as a green light. Ken Dillian, who's a colleague over at MSNBC, disagrees. Here he is with Chris Jansing yesterday on MSNBC, cut number nine.
Here's how devilishly complicated this is. This attempted hack on the RNC may not actually cross any red lines. If it was just espionage by a Russian intelligence agency to gather information, that's the kind of thing the United States does around the world every day. And so that's sort of in one bucket. We live with those kind of attacks. And even SolarWinds was essentially an espionage attack. It was a massive one.
We will talk with Secretary of State Pompeo about that as well. Former Secretary of State Pompeo in the third hour today. 36 states sued Google yesterday. 36, alleging damage to both consumers and app developers. Former President Trump sued Facebook, Twitter, and Google. He probably sued in the Ron District. He sued in Miami in the terms and conditions, say, California. And he's alleging First Amendment violations, which only can occur if there's state action. And that's a real stretch. You have to combine a bunch of different precedents, including city company town rules, which date back decades. And you have to argue that Section 230 invests them with quasi-government authority. then you've got to hope that the Brentwood test somehow finds the facts and circumstances to claim that it's a government action. It's a big reach. I don't think it's going to work. And then, well, I'll leave that for the economic news. A magnificent 2,000-year-old city hall has been unearthed near the Western Wall in Jerusalem. I urge you to go to timesofisrael.com to read about that. Pretty magnificent architectural. If you're going with Gallagher and Prager to the Holy Land this year, you're going to have a new site to see. I hope it will be open to the public by then. Don't go anywhere, America. We are on full for 3 hours here on the Thursday edition of The Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, Glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Kennedy, Hugh Hewitt. I'll be joined later in the program by former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Dr. Michael Lawrence calling from Israel, Michael Shermer from the New York Times. And now I have Leland Vitter on with me. Leland, good morning. How are you?
Hugh, good morning. Good to see you as always.
Thank you. I want to ask you, Leland, about, first of all, Ellie Reeve is a correspondent at CNN. I don't want you in a position to have to critique a colleague's work. Do you know her?
I do not.
Okay, great. And I don't. You wouldn't be unfair anyway, but I never like to criticize my colleagues at Salem or at NBC over their work. But I played her entire 10-minute piece yesterday on critical race theory, and I wanted to ask you, as a veteran television journalist, how you would cover the question, is CRT an issue? So give me some thoughts, Leland, before we go into her piece. If I said, I want 10 minutes explaining CRT, what would News Nation Now, your network, do?
Obviously something I've given a lot of thought to, and we've done a number of pieces on it. I think the idea would be you have to cover essentially both sides of it and give this idea of people who view this as the truth of what is America, in some way, America is inherently racist, systematically racist, and as I understand critical race theory, and this is something I'm not an expert on, but that you have a situation where people believe that any system that delivers unequal outcomes, unequal average outcomes based on race is inherently systematically racist. And that is a viewpoint, and that's a political viewpoint, if you will. And then you have to debate whether or not the people who believe that and don't believe that, and the people who believe that idea needs to be taught to children and that all of the tentacles of that idea need to be taught to children, or not. It's no different than a number of the other issues that have been covered over a long period of time in the United States, debating about specifically what should be taught to our kids and what should not. It goes all, you know, you think about all sorts of different discussions. Absence-only education was very a big deal when I was growing up in terms of exactly what is going to be taught to kids in public school and what is not. And parents obviously have a very strong feelings both ways.
So, Leland, I want to be fair to Ellie Reeve. She interviewed one parent, one teacher, one ill-informed man on the street. She used a clip from Ted Cruz, and she made many statements that are not objectively reporting, but are in fact propaganda, including this one, which I'd love to hear your reaction to. This is, again, a statement of fact by CNN reporter Ellie Reeve in the course of reporting on CRT. Can we play the crack cocaine one, please?
In the 90s, the crime bill gave much more severe sentencing to crack cocaine versus powder cocaine simply because Black people were perceived as doing crack cocaine and white people...
All right, so that's her statement of fact, Leland. How do you react to that as a statement of fact?
Again, this just isn't something I'm an expert on. And in terms of trying to critique somebody else's work in journalists without having that, I'll leave that to folks like you and their editors to come up with in terms of whether that's true or not.
Okay, I will give you I'll give you some background on it. The Crime Bill of 1994 has 350 plus pages in it. It's full of provisions. It's got sentencing guidelines for everything. At the time, as I recall, a crack cocaine received a higher penalty because it was perceived as a more significant risk of violence and more addictive than white powder cocaine. I do not recall, and indeed it would be unconstitutional, for anyone to approach the law from a premise that Ellie stated, that because Blacks were perceived as using crack cocaine, we made it tougher for Blacks going to prison. Indeed, the impact of it has been a disparate impact on length of sentence, which needs to be remedied, not itself the intent, disparate impact, but a result that's not unconstitutional. And it's also not hard to describe it accurately. But I want to play for the audience what Ellie said versus the capsule. I mean, that's a tiny little paragraph of what it is. Here's what she said.
In the 90s, the crime bill gave much more severe sentencing to crack cocaine versus powder cocaine simply because black people were perceived as doing crack cocaine and white people.
Okay, so simply because, Leland, I know you're not an expert on the crime bill or on CRT or CT. I am, so you're at a disadvantage. But do you think that would get past your editors at News Nation Now?
Well, I think you have to deal with this issue. And this, I think, is what you're trying to get at, which is it our job as journalists to take a result, which is, as you pointed out, that African-Americans received longer sentences because of this, and then go back and put in intent to it as someone in the clip that you played did. And that to me goes right to the issue of what we try to do, which is I'm a journalist. I ask the questions. I don't try and read in intent into what the given politicians were doing in the 1990s. And it's dangerous in any sense when we try to put intent into things that we don't know and we can't prove.
Now, I believe to be aggressive in questioning public figures is very appropriate. I've seen you do it, Leland Bitters. I've seen you go after politicians of both left and right very hard. I try and do it to be fair. I don't think it's a good practice of journalism to identify strong proponents of point A and weak defenders of point B and join them as an apparent both sides are covered. I think it's terrible journalism to present a sympathetic and articulate defender of the point of view you wish to push. In this case, that CRT doesn't exist and it's not dangerous if it did. It's not my dog. It didn't bite you besides you kicked it first. And then find an excited, impassioned, articulate proponent of the view that CRT is being taught too often and everywhere to great damage. I just don't even think that's controversial statement of how one ought to do journalism. Agree or disagree?
I'll go with what I've said so many times to you. Journalists make lousy media critics. And if we're going to keep our hat on as journalists, then you can't be a media critic. And I know that's become quite popular with folks. It's become a cottage industry for everyone to sit around and talk about each other and each other's segments. I'm just not sure how it serves the viewer. Different for an opinion show like yours, but for what I do, I just sort of I have enough difficulty sort of sticking to building my own rundown every day. And as we're getting ready to launch our show next week, that's where we're focused. July 19th. There you go. You see, Hugh, I was able to make some news for you.
I did not know. You're going on July 19th? Tell me about it.
We are going on July 19th, prime time. So we'll be able to do an hour. I know you can't come on with us, but we're looking forward to having some great conversations. But in the sense of this idea that if you're sitting in Iowa or you're sitting in New Hampshire, you're sitting anywhere other than in Washington, D.C., if you want the news and you don't want opinion, which people say that they want, you have to sort of ask this question. You know, if I do a segment about what the other 8 p.m. anchors are saying, and then I do another segment about what the other 8 p.m. anchors are saying about me saying about what the other 8 p.m. anchors are saying, does that really further the conversation at all? If you're sitting at home, are you any smarter? Are you any better informed about the issues that matter to you? Are you any better informed about whether or not your kids are going to have a better life than you do? And probably the answer is no.
No, Leland, that's such great news. I do not watch opinion journalism at night because I'm a mix of opinion and news. I begin with hard news and then I go around. I do some media criticism. I've got Mike Pompeo on, Mike Scheer today. But what you are promising is a return to the old model. And I'm going to hold you to it. The old model is just the news. So is it 8 p.m. on News Nation now?
Here's the deal. Here's the deal. And that is that if you're going to hold me to that, that means you actually have to watch.
I'm going to.
Really appreciate because we need the rating.
Yeah. Well, 8 p.m. Monday through Friday, News Nation Now. Is that what it's going to be?
There you go.
How many segments are you going to do, Leland?
It looks like we got about 5 blocks. So I think the news of the day will dictate the segments. Sometimes you're going to end up with 20 minutes on something in the beginning of the day. I know I was talking to your producer earlier. One story we were pitching around earlier that we really like is this story out of China, how there's a Chinese company now that is using their pregnancy tests and neonatal tests to develop genetic sequencing of millions of Americans.
And, Dwayne just sent me that. I am deeply disturbed, and I will be discussing that with Mike Pompeo on today's show. It may be I brought him on to talk about Russian hacking, but that is a deeply disturbing story. So I hope you will cover that. So 5 blocks, 8 p.m. Do you have a co-host? Are you doing it all yourself, Leland?
Unfortunately for the viewers, it'll be just me.
No, you're good at this, and you keep it moving. Now, the last thing, the only reason I don't watch a lot of television is too damn slow. Pardon my French. It just moves along like an elephant lumbering through the jungle. How are you going to fight that?
Well, elephants are quite popular. You know, people love them, watching them on Twitter and YouTube, I hear. But I think part of it is, though, what you went back to, which is opinion journalism takes a long time because you've got to lay out your opinions. You've got to be outraged about your opinions. Then you've got to provide all these proof for your opinions. When you're just telling people what the news is, it can actually move pretty quickly. And if you've got guests who are more interesting than yourself and smarter than yourself, they can help as well.
Leland, is it Monday Night Launch?
Monday, July 19th.
And what's the name of the show?
On Balance.
On Balance. Bravo, Leland Vitter. We'll see you on Monday night at 8 p.m. And we'll be playing his tape almost every day here on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Stay with us. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt, joined by Dr. Michael Oren, former U.S. ambassador, U.S. ambassador to the United States from Israel. He joins me from Tel Aviv suburb Jaffa, I believe, this morning. How are you, Dr. Oren? Welcome back. Happy summer.
Thank you. Great to be back, Hugh. All's well.
I have got lots to talk to you about. I want to start, though, with some breaking news. Reuters reported yesterday that a Chinese gene company, BGI, is saving and using all of the blood samples from the 8 million people who have taken the test to analyze the genomes of the women and to improve population quality on the basis of genetic research. What do you make of that practice? And given that Israel is the sort of startup capital of the world and high-tech capital of the world, why didn't Israel do this first? I'd rather you folks have this than the Chinese Communist Party.
I think, well, first of all, it's dangerous. It's horrendous stuff. And it's genetic engineering of human beings. But I think that I have been told here by security sources that you have to be very, very careful about with whom you are sharing your DNA and your genetic information. Like there are a number of online ancestry type websites and apps. The minute they have your DNA and you don't know what their security situation is, whether they can be easily hacked, that your DNA could be all over the world right now. Everybody knows. Think about that. And you've lost all control over what's being done with your genetic profile.
Now, if it's with the Chinese military, that means it's with the Chinese Communist Party. And they actually have a fairly hegemonic view of themselves. How would you describe the ambitions of General Secretary Xi as he articulated them at the 100th Party Congress?
Oh, it's very aggressive. Very combative and muscular. It was clear that his China is aspiring for a type of world domination, certainly on the economic sphere, and that's played out through the Belt and Road Initiative, which is $13 trillion. The Chinese have built 35 ports around the world, including the entrance to the Red Sea. They're planning to build 2 ports on the Persian Gulf in Sri Lanka, all very strategic, and they have this practice of lending money to a country to build a port, and then the country defaults on the loan, and the Chinese take over the port. The Chinese, for example, the Chinese Navy has the largest military base in all of Africa, largest by far.
Yep, and they're building a bigger one even still. Let me ask you, Dr. Oren, about the Israeli-China relationship and the Israeli-Iran relationship. Obviously, I'm concerned about the JCPOA suddenly springing back to life with absolutely no modifications on its sunset, its missile programs, its export of terrorism, and the newer relationship between Iran and China. It sure looks to me like China, Russia, and Iran are lining up on the risk game that is the world. Does it look that way to you?
Well, certainly with the Chinese and the Iranians, they've now signed this $400 billion, 25-year treaty with the Iranians. In exchange for discount Iranian oil, the Chinese will give the Iranians access to technology, including military technology. So a source of great concern for us. I personally believe that the Chinese are the only country like people capable of rebuilding Syria, for example. The UN price tag for rebuilding Syria after the civil war is at least $250 billion. And the Russians can't do that. The Iranians can do it. I wouldn't be surprised to see Chinese corporations building there. Certainly they're building right here in Tel Aviv, right? You know, a couple of yards from where I'm talking to you, they're building our subway system. And they're building our rebuilding our two major ports in Ashdod and Haifa, good builders. So it's a source of great concern for us. Now, we have an open relationship with China. We have, you know, certainly a close commercial relationship with China, and we walk a bit of a tightrope. The U.S. Navy, for example, has made it very clear to us, by the way, both under the Obama administration and the Trump administrations, that if the Chinese rebuild our port in Haifa, that the U.S. Sixth Fleet will not call into port there. They can't trust it. Interesting. We walk a tightrope.
Tell me about, because I'm going to talk with former Secretary of State Pompeo next hour. Tell me about whether Israel is the site of many cyber attacks such as plagued the United States from Russia over the past 2 weeks, not just the RNC, but thousands of businesses. Are those attacks mounted from the same people, as far as you know, in Israel?
As from some of the many people. If you come here, we have an entire cyber campus down in Beersheba, and I would strongly recommend you go there. They have a board that shows you actually physically what cyber attacks are being mounted at Israel at any given time. And it's mind-boggling. It's coming from so many different directions. But Israel is a world leader in cyber defense. We account for 20% of all the investment in cyber defense in the world. This is a country of, you know, less than 10 million people. But none of these defenses are foolproof. They're not infallible. And sometimes they get in. We've had a semi-successful attack on our water system. And, you know, what part of our attack, part of our defense strategy is also offensive capabilities. So we're working on it very, very robustly. But I recommend you reach that center, because it is staggering to look at the sheer number of attacks that are mounted at any given time.
Well, that's why I think they collapsed the Jedi contract. They realize they can't really run American cyber defense in its cloud via the old competitive bidding process. They have to get collaboration going. So, Dr. Oren, I want to turn to the domestic political situation there, because it always affects the world. You've got a 59-59 failure to approve a citizenship law that is necessary to preserve Israel as a Jewish state. Is that dead, dead, dead? How is the coalition faring? What do you project in the near and the medium term?
Instability, but I don't think much is going to change. And it's for this reason that Netanyahu and Bennett need one another. Netanyahu needs a government that's very vulnerable. You know, whether he shoots left or right, it's always going to be a mortal hit for this government. And Bennett needs Netanyahu, because Netanyahu in opposition and poised to return to the prime ministership is the raison d'etre of this government. It's why it exists. And if the opposition is headed by anybody else, this government will fall apart. So it's kind of a strange two-edged Faustian deal between Bennett and Netanyahu. And so neither is going to push particularly hard. And, you know, Netanyahu would like to go to another round of elections. He's going to maybe wait a few months. But right now, you know, there is that confluence of interests between these two leaders.
Now, as I read the Israeli press, Bennett made the vote on the citizenship law a party vote. He had someone defect from Yamina, others abstain. It did not get 60 votes. Does that bring down the coalition, or is that going to be the budget, if anything?
Now, the budget will be the what can bring down a coalition is the budget, not this law. The law just basically got the can kicked down the road. And at the end of the day, the Interior Ministry will decide who becomes a citizen and who doesn't, according to its own internal criteria. The budget, you can't fudge in that way. And it's going to be contentious. And the government is going to be at the height of its vulnerability during those budget debates.
When must that vote come, whether or not? Because that will tell me whether it's going to survive 2 years, 3 years, or 3 months.
Well, it's going to start now, but then the Knesset breaks for August, and then you go right into the Jewish holidays of September. So the actual debate will be in October.
And so the culminating vote in October will know whether it's a stable government for a year?
Yeah, and I think I said on your show previously, if the government survives 2 weeks, it'll probably survive 2 months. And if it survives 2 months, or even to October, it could survive for much, much longer.
All right. Now, let me turn to the good news. Lead story in the Times of Israel, magnificent 2,000-year-old city hall unearthed near Western Wall. Now, I've been in the tunnels many times, I guess three times now, and I'm always amazed by them. I don't know if this is a new discovery or simply the opening and re-understanding or elaboration on an old discovery. What's your understanding, Dr. Oren?
I think that under the old city, listen, all the excavations in Israel represent a fraction of what could be excavated. Even a site like Masada, 15% has been excavated. And the city of David outside just maybe 5% of it has been excavated. So our past lies beneath the ground. Our problem in the past has been the Muslim waqf that controls the Temple Mount. It was a decision made by Moshe Dayan back in 1957 to cede control of the Temple Mount to the waqf. I think we've lived with the ramifications of that decision ever since. And in recent years, the waqf has dug into the Temple Mount and destroyed just incalculable numbers of antiquities and tried to erase any trace of our Jewish history in that area. And we've had archaeologists sifting through the rubble looking for artifacts and evidence. It's pathetic. And the Israeli government didn't stand up to the walk. So and discovering like this that once again authenticizes our historic connection to this land, it has great not just archaeological ramifications, it has political and diplomatic ramifications.
You know, Daniel Silva, our mutual fund friend, made a great Alon novel about the walk.
Yes.
And it's one of his best.
I think it's one of his best, too. Yeah.
I just can't. It's so absolutely believable because of the background you just spelled out. I can't believe there's actually still an effort to deny the Second Temple period. When I read stories like this, the Western Wall Tunnel expansion, right, I'm just amazed that anyone tries to argue with the rocks.
Well, tell that to the Palestinian leadership. You know, Palestinian leadership will say we're in favor of a two-state solution, but they will never say they're in favor of two states for two peoples, because according to the Palestinians, the Jews aren't a people. And we are, you know, refugees from Europe. We have no historical connection to this land. We're not authentic. We're not indigenous. And it's essential to their case. Temple denial is related to people denial, which ultimately is going to be related to Holocaust denial and history denial. That is essential to the Palestinian narrative.
All right, a quick closing question on the new president of Iran and what it represents in the JCPOA negotiations. I like to sound the alarm every week, Michael. I am afraid that any day Wendy Sherman is going to emerge from Vienna with peace in our time proclamations.
Yeah, I share that worry. Boy, do I share that worry. And we can say in the we here that the Israelis are very skeptical of the administration's ability to do good on its promise to bring a longer and stronger agreement, because they will be giving up, you know, they'll be giving up so much leverage in terms of lifting sanctions. And, you know, we're going to have to prepare ourselves for the best. I went on record this week saying to the Israeli and Jewish press that the renewal of the JCPOA puts us on a path to a regional war, not a local war. It'll make the recent war with Hamas look like a picnic. And people have to know that when they renew this agreement, they are putting the Middle East, thrusting us down the road to this type of war. And for us, we're going to have to gird ourselves as strongly as possible, as quickly as possible. And I hope we can do that in conversation with the United States.
Grim news. One last question quickly, Michael. Whenever the Olympics get underway, and I was talking about the Olympics, I'm reminded of 1972. Is that always a reflex in Israel? Are there always lookbacks at 72 when the Olympic torch is lit?
I do. I can't look at the Olympics without thinking that. It was a formative period for me. And you know, the German reaction or absence of reaction to the Munich massacre, the fact that the Palestinians today name schools and soccer fields after the perpetrators of that massacre was extraordinary. They actually acknowledge it as a day of heroism. I had an article in Time magazine about it several years ago.
I guess it's for people our age. I just was transfixed. I couldn't take my eyes off of the hotel. And one of the great tragedies of my life, certainly more yours and Israel's, I'll remember it again when the flame gets lit. Michael Oren, thank you. Dr. Dr. Michael Oren on Twitter. Don't forget relieffactor.com, our terrific sponsor. As the Olympics get underway, you see all those great athletes. Well, they train. Training means aches and pains. Training means, well, you can take Aleve or Advil or any other kind of anti-inflammatory. You can try. Just try relieffactor.com. $19.95 gets you 3 weeks of Relief Factor sent to your house. Can't buy it in a store. Go and get it. Try it. If you're like me, you'll use it every single day. You'll keep a supply on hand and you'll feel better and go further. Every single day will be a little bit better because of ReliefFactor.com. But you have to take the first step, not only in walking, running, swimming, whatever, but in getting ReliefFactor.com. I'll be right back. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining me. I'm inside the Beltway where we're melting and continue to melt. So is Michael Shear, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Michael, I don't have to go out much. I go out to do my run after the show every morning. But what about you? Are you just huddled inside with standing in front of a fan or the AC?
I wish. I was out yesterday. I traveled to Illinois with the president yesterday. So I was in and out and walking around the city. And I was just soaking wet most of the time. So,
oh, it's miserable. And the old tan suit doesn't work. The old poplin suit doesn't work. It's just miserable. Michael, I want to talk to you about President Biden and then about critical race theory. But first, okay. Did President Biden in any of the stops this week discuss CRT as it's exploded as a news story?
No, I mean, he focused on the two things he focused on this week so far, anyway, are the vaccine and the virus, and then yesterday spent the day talking about his American Families plan, the $1.8 trillion plan to spend a lot of money.
Do they regret, you know, I've been pushing people to get the vaccine every day because it's just crazy to roll the dice. I keep pleading with my audience, if you're among the people that are not vaccinated, I've had one friend die and many people hospitalized and lots of people have had a cold. I know you had it. You stayed home. You didn't get hospitalized. So it's just everywhere. And why roll the dice? But does the president and his team regret saying we're going to go door to door? Hi, I'm from the federal government. I want to give you a shot, because that's not actually helping.
Yeah, well, it was interesting that on the plane yesterday, Jen Psaki was asked this sort of a question that I thought was an interesting way of putting it, which was that you know, does the White House feel stuck between the two extremes? On the one hand, the position that you're taking or suggesting, which is that was not helpful. And on the other hand, being pushed by a lot of professional healthcare people to do more to push mandates, not necessarily a federal mandate, but, you know, do more to encourage private companies and schools and universities and state governments to mandate the vaccine. So you sort of have these two extremes. And the administration's kind of trying to walk that middle line. Psaki's response was, yeah, there's something to that. But I do think that they were a little surprised by the extent to which when they suggested the sort of knocking door to door that it blew up on the right as much as it did.
Well, I don't think it's just on the right. You know, I live in very comfortably safe neighborhoods on both coasts. I hate answering the door. I don't like my wife to ever answer the door when I'm not there. And even when I'm there, who goes door to door these days except proselytizing missionaries and, sketchy. Well, can you contribute?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I remember back in the day, you'll remember this too, Hugh, when the Obamacare website was first being launched, right, during all the when it had all the technical problems and the like. And I remember going down to Florida with some of the Obamacare sort of proselytizers and literally watching them as they knocked door to door to try to get people to sign up for Obamacare. And I mean, I think probably at least 50%, if not more, of the doors just got slammed in their face for the reason I think that you're talking about, which is that people just don't appreciate that. And so it does make me wonder, is that even politics aside, like, is that an effective strategy in today's sort of connected, you know, the iPhone kind of era? Like, do people want folks to be knocking on their door regardless of whether they agree or don't agree about, sort of what it is?
And believe me, as a Catholic school kid, for 12 years. I had to knock on a million doors selling candy bars, magazines, gift wrap, whatever it is. And, you know, it was different then in the 70s and the 60s.
It does seem like a different era,
You know, and so it's just not a good idea. Moreover, I spent a lot of time on air and off air with Andy Slavitt, who's a good guy, a smart guy, talking about how you have to use proxies with your groups. Now, the most resistant group is African-American, second most resistant, rural conservatives. Okay, right. Who talks to the former? Who talks to the latter? Talk to them to talk to them. That's, I think, the strategy. And Michael Scheer, did Jen talk about that on the plane? Proxies?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, you know, she talked about it. Biden talked about it in his remarks that, you know, they still part of their strategy. I mean, the door knocking got a lot of news, but you know, the other announcements were essentially that. Let's get the vaccine into people's doctor's offices because they trust their doctor. Let's do it at pediatricians' offices for the kids over 12 that can get the shot. You know, let's talk to the people in the communities, the church pastors, the teachers in the schools, the people who folks trust, whether, you know, whichever group you're in, they tend to trust the people who are closest to them, not far away politicians in Washington. And I think, you know, the question is, you know, they've been trying that for 3-4 months now, and it worked. But now it sort of seems like it's plateauing. And the question is, can you really boost the vaccine, kind of the rate of people taking vaccines just with that?
Well, you know, the single most effective thing I think they could do, really, the single most is to invite Robert Jeffries to the White House and have Biden sit down with him. Pastor Jeffress. And he is about as conservative as they come. And he's also pro-vaccine. And to compliment your opponent publicly is the best way to do this. And I'd do the same with African-American pastors, Latino pastors. There are lots of them. If you want to reach groups, you got to go to the people they trust. Now, Mike, I want to ask you a professional question. I'm not going to ask you to beat up on what's Elle's last name? I've never heard of her until yesterday from CNN. She did maybe the worst report on critical race theory I've ever heard. So I want to ask you an objective question. If your editor calls up and says, "Scheer, we need 1,500 words on the critical race theory debate," what would you do? How would you go about reporting that story?
Well, look, I mean, I think that the issue of critical race theory that is really at the heart of the question is, you know, whether or not some kind of theory of the, you know, is being sort of forced down the throats of, you know, people, whether they be employees, students, you know, federal government employees, the like. And I think what I would do is try to sort of truth test the idea of whether or not this is, being inappropriately taught in settings that it shouldn't be, being taught in. I mean, there are views on all sides of, you know, history. And I think, you know, as a person who values, all the different points of view getting out there, I think, that's maybe not the problem. The problem that I see conservatives talking about a lot is that it's being pushed in places that it shouldn't be pushed. And so I would sort of try to get out there and truth squad that. What's really true?
You see, I would approach it with the traditional who, what, where, why, how. What is it? It's a subset of critical legal theory, which began at Harvard Law School in the mid-70s, pushed by Mark Tushnet and mostly Duncan Kennedy, that spread throughout the legal academy. Where did it start? Harvard, it spread through the legal academy. Now it's in the academic academy generally. Why? Because it's advantageous to a legal theory and to an ideology that has many steps in it. How? Often in textbooks, usually through curriculum, sometimes by teachers. Why? To ideologize, that's not a word, but I'm using it, students.
That's a good one.
And ideologize means to, you know, just transform students and to convert them. And it's a fair question. I just don't see it fairly reported. This CNN report, let's play, Michael, one clip of a fact statement in this report.
in the 90s, the crime bill gave much more severe sentencing to crack cocaine versus powder cocaine simply because black people were perceived as doing crack cocaine and white people.
Now, that's made by a CNN reporter, Ellie Reed. Would that get past your editor, Mike?
I mean, the first piece of that statement, if I heard it right, was a kind of a factual statement. Second piece was a, you know, a sort of analysis of why the crime bill had the motivations essentially of the people that passed the crime bill and passed those sentences for crack versus powdered cocaine. And I think, you know, that sounded to me like a kind of more, kind of opinionated view of that than a reported one. To me, what you would want to do is go back and actually report out the history of the passage of the crime bill and report that.
You know, it was a reductionist and biased view, because you would begin by saying in 1994, a 350-page-plus crime bill was passed, one provision of which established sentences for crack cocaine that were different from sentences from powder cocaine. Many critics believe, and honestly, I just think reporting is falling apart on this. I know yours hasn't. I hope you get assigned that by your editor if you're listening, New York Times, because Michael Scheer would do a good job. Thank you, Michael. Follow him at Scheer M on Twitter as he journeys around through the sultry summer of D.C. with the president. Stay tuned. I'll be right back.